Joshua chapter 4, reading verses 6 and 7. That this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, "What mean you by these stones?" that you shall answer them, "That the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it passed over Jordan, the waters of Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever." I've entitled this sermon, "Stones, Signs, and Sacraments." We remember, as we read in chapter 5, that the children of Israel were asked to keep, to be circumcised, and to keep, they kept the Passover. And of course, circumcision and the Passover are the precursors of the New Testament sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper. Now, last week, as we looked at chapter 3, we noted the miraculous crossing of the River Jordan of 2 million Israelites. And they are to cross the Jordan, to enter the land of Canaan, to drive out the Canaanites. And now that they have so miraculously crossed the River Jordan, what's the first thing they are to do? Get on with the work? No. The first thing they're to do is to erect a monument of stones. Now that's amazing. If you read verse 1 of chapter 5, you'll discover that the Canaanites, whenever they saw the Israelites coming over Jordan on dry land, their hearts began to melt for fear. Now Joshua is a war general, a commander of the army. And you would say, well, now's the time to strike. Our enemies are terrified. Our enemies are afraid. Now is the time to strike. That would be the normal procedure. A normal tactic of war. Strike while the enemy's weak. But no. Erect a monument of stones. That's what they're to do. Let's look at that first of all. We'll look at what it says here, that these stones are a sign among you. And then we'll look at why, what we're just calling the sacrament, why they're to be circumcised, and to why they held the Passover. Now, erecting the monument of stones. You see, it wasn't enough for Israel to cross the river. They must remember it. They must remember crossing the river. According to Deuteronomy chapter 8, one of the greatest enemies of faith, it seems, is forgetfulness. But you know, in the Bible, forgetfulness is nothing whatsoever to do with a bad memory. You know how many of us complain of our bad memories these days? Well, in the scriptures, forgetfulness hasn't to do with our mental makeup. Forgetfulness has to do with not taking steps to remember things that we ought to remember. That's what's important. God is saying to the Israelites here, erect a monument to remind you of these things. We are to take steps to help us remember things of significance in our spiritual lives. That's very interesting. Miracles. The crossing of the River Jordan was a miracle. Now, it's interesting just to note that if miracles are meant to be everyday occurrences, as some people would claim they're meant to be if we live by faith, if they're meant to be everyday occurrences, why erect a memorial? Of course, it is precisely because miracles are not everyday occurrences. Even to the life of faith, we're to erect memorials. We are to take steps to remember the great things that God has done for us in our Christian lives. You see, memorials require something significant to remember. We are to remember, you see, and for the children of Israel here, what was the crossing of the River Jordan all about? It wasn't all about, well, entertaining the people of Canaan. It wasn't even about entertaining the people of Israel. See what God can do. See the powers he's got. And it's very interesting that Jesus Christ would never ever perform a miracle when it wasn't necessary. And we noted, for example, in verse 12 of chapter 5, that the manna ceased the day they crossed into the River Jordan into Canaan. Why did it cease that very day? Well, just to demonstrate it was a miracle. But you see, now that they were in Canaan and no longer in the wilderness, now that there was corn in the land, now that there was fruit to eat, there was no need for God to perform a miracle. God does not perform unnecessary miracles. Even to the man of faith and the woman of faith, only when it's necessary will God perform a miracle. Memorials require then something significant to remember. What is all crossing the River Jordan all about? What was significant about it? It was, the significant part is this. It was God demonstrating his power to fulfill his promise, even after 40 years. God said to the Israelites in Egypt, I will take you into the promised land. I'll take you into Canaan. After 40 long years, it takes place. And even after 40 years, as the River Jordan, which could swell to a 1 mile in width, as it spread before the Israelites, you could say, it'll never happen. How will you get these 2 million over that mile wide river without a bridge, without a boat? It can't be done. That's what's significant. God keeping his promise after 40 long years. And you see, a memorial requires something for the future. For future generations to remember. You see, it's a very, very short-sighted to think only of our own age. We are to think of future generations. And that's why the children of Israel here were to build a monument. So that when your children in ages to come inquire, when they ask, what's this about? When they ask, how did you get across that river, Dad? Well, they're to point to this memorial. God dried up the river. That mile-wide river, raging river, God dried it up just in a day. And we walked over in dry land. Future generations are to know about it. And it's interesting also to note that it was something that united the 12 tribes of Israel. Notice it was the 12 tribes. You remember that 2.5 tribes said, look, instead of crossing the River Jordan into Canaan, can we have our portion on this side of the river? The 2.5 tribes, we mentioned them there. Could they do it? Yes, verse 12. chapter 4. The children of Reuben and the children of Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh, they passed over armed with them, with the 12, to erect this memorial. It wasn't just the 9.5 tribes that were going to be in across the Jordan. It united the whole, every tribe of the Israelites. Now, there's lessons in all this for us. There's lessons to be taught by it. And you see, that was the whole point of it. When your children, as he said, verse 6, this may be a sign among you. Now, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, what mean you by these stones? Then you shall answer them. And you see, Christianity is something that's meant to answer questions, something that's meant to expand our minds. It's something intelligent that there are answers to. And you see, you remember this, the Savior himself pointed this out. When the disciples began to shoo away the children that were attracted to Jesus, they, as it were, said, well, you're too young for this. This is above your heads. And Christ rebuked them and said, no, no, no. Let the little children come to me. Let them understand. Now here is a lesson for the Israelites. Make your religion so simple, so easily understood, that when your children ask a question, you've got a ready answer that you can explain to them. Now you see, what does all this teach us about erecting monuments? What do the stones teach us? What lessons are there here for Christianity? Christianity, you see, one thing we learn, is not a whimsical, spur-of-the-moment thing. Christianity isn't to be a passing fad or some impulsive bee-in-the-bonnet phobia we might have. Christianity, you see, is something historical. Christianity grew out of Judaism. It grew from this. And you remember, we've noted already how the New Testament takes scriptures out of the book of Joshua and applies them to the Christian age, because it's relevant. And Christianity, you see, is something that expands generations. It isn't just something for this age, and it's, I think, something that the church may be making a mistake of today. We're looking at this age. There are more ages than this age. There are ages to come. There are ages that have been passed. What are the lessons to learn from that? Christianity hasn't arisen during our age. Christianity has been around for 2,000 years, and it grew out of Judaism in the past. Stones. Secondly, signs. Verse 6. This may be a sign among you. Now, what's the biblical teaching on signs? Just three things we'd mention. The first thing that's very important is to notice signs are for others. Signs are not for ourselves. Now, the best verse to quote for this is 1 Corinthians 14, verse 22, when it's speaking about tongues, which are a sign. Wherefore, tongues are for a sign. 1 Corinthians 14, 22 says, a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. But prophesying or teaching serves not for them that believe not, those outside, but for them which believe, that are inside. Tongues are a sign, not for those who believe, but for those who believe not, for outsiders, for others. Now we believe, of course, that signs were given only at the initiation of the Christian religion 2,000 years ago. And they faded away as the apostles faded away. But we learn something about signs and about gifts. Gifts are not for our personal use. They are for the use of others. And that's significant. That's very important. They're for the use of others. And you see, some people say, for example, about tongues, "Oh, I feel better after it." Well, according to the biblical teaching, signs are not for our own benefit. They are for other people's benefit. And that's why when people spoke in tongues in the Bible, they were foreign languages. They were real. They weren't just mumblings. They were real foreign languages. And that's why there was always the instruction, be sure, when someone speaks in tongues, there's someone to interpret that foreign language. So that there's edification. So that those outside understand what's been taught and what's been said. And there's a basic principle there. And you see, the fact that signs are for others shows us that in the early church, you know, was very concerned with evangelism, with spreading, with growth, with expansion, bringing the Christian message to others outside. Who was it that said that the church is the only organization on earth that exists for the benefit of its non-members? The church, the only organization on earth that exists for the benefit of its non-members. And I often think of that when Christ gave his last address, said his last words to the church. Go tell every creature. Signs are for others. This memorial was for the benefit of others. Second thing to note about signs were signs were to invoke questions. This memorial, this monument that was built, people were meant to say, "Hey, what's this for?" Meant to ask questions. People are meant to come up and ask questions. And you know, that happened again in the early church. People came spontaneously to these early Christians and asked them questions. Why do you do this? Why do you do that? Why are you different? And we might very well ask ourselves today, why does nobody ask us questions? Why does nobody spontaneously come to us to ask, why do you do that? Why do you do this? Well, maybe it's because nobody notices we're different. Because, well, perhaps maybe we aren't. Perhaps maybe we're too much like the world. But we're meant to be different, to invoke questions. That people come up to you and say, "I notice you didn't do this. All of us were going here, but you didn't. I notice you were the only one that did this." Christians are meant to be different, to invoke questions. Maybe, of course, we're just not normal and not mixing with others as we ought. And you see, Christians were never meant to withdraw from the world. They're meant to influence the world. They're meant to conquer the world. Not meant to withdraw and opt out and have nobody to speak to unless they're Christians. That's foreign. We're meant to make the world ask questions of us. Here, why do you do that? Why do you pray before you eat? Why do you go to church in the middle of the week? Why do you do all these sort of things? Why don't you go where the others go? We're meant to invoke questions. That's a sign. We are to be signed sufficiency for Christ. Which leads us actually to the third thing about a sign. Perhaps a better word for sign would be signpost. You see, signs are not only for others. Signs are not only to invoke these others to ask questions. But signs are meant to point to something. Rather than the sign above a building, naming the company that works in the building, the idea is a signpost on the road at a juncture pointing this way or that way. Signs are signposts. Signs are to point to something. And you see, Christians are meant to point somewhere. We're meant to point to something. What are we meant to point to? We're meant to point to Jesus. So that when somebody sees us, they see Jesus. It's a very bad sign when a Christian makes himself attractive so that people speak about him. People, when they meet us, should speak about Jesus. They should say, that guy is obsessed with this man, Jesus. That's a good sign. That's a good witness. That's a good testimony. But people say, oh, he's obsessed with the Bible, that person. He's just obsessed. He can't get away from it. Speak to him and he'll speak about the Bible. That's a good witness. You're pointing to something. You're not pointing to yourself. Christians are not to say, look at me. Christians are not meant to say, follow me. Christians are meant to say, look at Jesus. Christians are meant to say, follow the Bible. Follow Christ. That's what a sign is. It's a signpost pointing. And you see, these stones pointed to God. They pointed to what God did. They pointed to God's power. They pointed to God's promise, I will bring the Israelites into the promised land. They pointed to the fact that God is merciful to sinners. They pointed particularly to the fact that God is faithful. God kept his promise to the Israelites these 40 years. After 40 years of sin in the wilderness, after 40 years of complaint in the wilderness, God still brought Israelites into Canaan. Now, you see, the Israelites, as we will come to note now, it was not the same generation that came out of Egypt that went into Canaan. And of course, you may remember why. Because they grieved God through their unbelief and their sin. And they said, God, you can't take us into Canaan. It's impossible. And whereby God said, well, if you insist, you won't go into Canaan. But I will take your children into Canaan. If you don't want to go, that's okay. But I'll bring your children instead. I will bring Israelites into Canaan. If you don't want to be the nation that go, I'll bring another generation. But I will bring Israelites into the land of Canaan. And not even your sin can stop me bringing Israel into Canaan. That's wonderful. And that's what the stones were to represent. And they were to this, you were a sign to God's faithfulness in keeping his promise. He promised this a generation to bring them into Canaan. They were determined not to. They were determined God couldn't do it. So God said, all right, if you don't want to go, okay. I'll bring your children. But I will bring Israelites into Canaan. There's a message there for you and me. God is going to save sinners. If not you, then others. But he will save sinners. It was a sign for God's mercy, God's faithfulness, God's plan, God's promise, God's power. That's what it was pointing to. Well, our third heading. Signs. It's salt stones, signs, and the sacraments. From chapter 5, verse 2, you'll see that they were to circumcise the children of Israel again. And in verse 11, you'll see that they kept the Passover. Now, as the Israelites crossed the Jordan, and as they were to enter into battle against the Canaanites, what's their biggest problem? Is it the ferocity of the Canaanites? Is it how powerful the Canaanites' weaponry of war was? Was that the biggest problem? What was their biggest problem? You know what their biggest problem was? Their biggest problem was the same as it is today. It was themselves. Or more specifically, I suppose, our unbelief. Our lack of faith. And that's why God says, now look, before you start the war, worship me. Worship me. Circumcise yourselves. And then they held the Passover. Now you'll note in verse 2 of chapter 5, at that time the Lord said unto Joshua, make these sharp knives and circumcise again the children of Israel the second time. Now that does not mean, as it might seem to mean in the Authorized Version, that they were circumcised twice. It means this is the second occasion that the Israelites were to be circumcised together. The first time was 38 years ago. But, as we read there in chapter 5, verse 5, now all the people that came out were circumcised, but all the people that were born in the wilderness, by the way, as they came forth out of Egypt, they had not been circumcised. But now, all together, up to 38 years of age, these Israelites were to be circumcised together. Now what did that signify? What did that mean? Well, of course, as we've indicated already, it meant they were to be identified with God. This crossing the Jordan, this coming out of Egypt and going into Canaan, it wasn't the Israelites' idea. Never crossed their minds to do it. It was God's idea. It was God's plan. It was God's name that was at stake. And that they were God's people. The ones that God said we would take into Canaan. They had to have a mark upon them. This, you see, had to do with God. God's idea. God's name. God's honour. God's will. The Israelites had to be identified with God. But note also, it had to tested their faith. Because you see, as you can see from verse 8, once you were circumcised, it incapacitated you for battle. And you remember there's a very, very sad account of the Jacob's children in Genesis chapter 34. Verse 25 in particular, you'll see how when the men of war were circumcised, they weren't able to fight. They were in such pain. Now, you see, Joshua, why are you asking us to be circumcised? We're incapacitated for battle. The Canaanites are there looking at us. And we're going to be unfit for war for what? How many days? See, it tested their faith. It really did test their faith. But isn't there a verse in the Bible that says, through weakness we're made strong? Maybe you can't understand today why God is incapacitating you when you have this great work to do, and you say, well, it's for God, but I'm so weak. Listen, here's the lesson, one lesson for us to learn today. Through weakness we're made strong. Remember Paul? When I am weak, then I am strong. It's a lesson we've to learn. Our strength is in God, not in our capability, not in our efficiency. You'll note from verse 9 that the circumcision also removed the reproach of Egypt. What was the reproach of Egypt? Well, God told them, I'll take you out of Egypt to place you in the land of promise, to place you in Canaan. Well, God did miraculously take them out of Egypt. Miraculously. But 38, 39 years down the line, they're not in Egypt. And you see, they're not in Canaan. And that was a reproach. And they were being spoken about, said, your God took you out of Egypt. Can't take you into the promised land. You can't cross the river. You've been here for 38 years. That was a reproach. Your God can't do what he said he would do. He said he'd take you into Canaan 40 years down the line. You're not there yet. That was a reproach. But see what verse. This day, he says, verse 9, chapter 5. And the Lord said unto Joshua, this day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off you. This day I'm going to take you into the promised land. God, you see, was not going to be outdone even by the sin of the Israelites. He delayed them going into the land of Canaan 40 years because of their sin. But he says, it's not going to stop me keeping my promise to take you into Canaan. It'll delay it. It'll mean it's another generation who will go in. But I am faithful to my word. Israel will inherit Canaan. If one generation doesn't want it, well, another generation will. And he rolled away the reproach. So that God was able to keep his word and take the Israelites into the land of promise. Sin, you see, is very, very powerful. But it has no power to stop God keeping his promise. It has power to keep you out of heaven. It has power to delay. But sin itself even has no power to stop God keeping his promise. God can overcome sin. God's wonderful grace. Well, you note also, of course, that they kept the Passover. And of course, if they kept it, according to their instructions, it would have been a 7-day occurrence. 7-day feast. Now, of course, again, that was an act of faith. You see how vulnerable they would be before the Canaanites, that they were going to fight. And the Canaanites knew that they were coming in to drive them out. And they'd say, well, look, after waiting to be healed after the circumcision, our men of war, are we going to have to wait another 7 days to go through this feast? You see, God, you see, it would have been an act of faith. Why don't we get on with the job? Drive out these Canaanites. If we don't get on with this, you can hear them saying, we're going to be massacred. We're vulnerable. Having a worship service for 7 days before the face of our enemies. We've missed our opportunity. Hearts were melting for fear. That was a time to strike. But now all this time has passed. Yet you see, it was an act of faith. keeping the Passover, being circumcised. Now, as we close, what are the lessons? Three. Number one, worshipping God is never a waste of time. Worshipping God is of primary importance, even in a time of war. This is a time of war. They were to engage in battle. But if they worship God, what blessings can happen? Lesson number two. God wants to be remembered, not for his acts of judgment so much, as his acts of mercy and his acts of faithfulness. They were to erect a memorial to rejoice in God and to remember his works of mercy. That's what God wants to be remembered for. And we're to take steps to remember God's goodness and God's faithfulness. And the last lesson, as we've mentioned, hinted at already, God's grace is more powerful than Israel's sin. God's grace was, I want to take Israelites into the promised land. But Israel was so determined and so rebellious in their sin that they wouldn't do it. So God said, well, all right, I'll take others. And you know, it's the same with the gospel. God is determined to take human beings into heaven. If you're not interested, God will take others. But God will have human beings in heaven. Why don't you become one of them? Why don't you set your face to be one of those people that God will take to glory? That's what he wants. And that's what he wants to be remembered for. And that's what he wants to put on record. May God bless his word to us. Let's pray.